Welcome to our very last talk of the day. Our speakers now are Professor Ross Anderson and Dr. Robert Brady. Professor Anderson is Professor of Security Engineering at the Computer Laboratory, where he's also part of the security group. And Dr. Brady is an Industrial Research Fellow at the Computer Laboratory, and both have very strong ties to Trinity College, as they may cover in their talk. And they're going to speak on can mathematics be heretical? And so, my pleasure to introduce them both. Thanks.
Well, thanks for that introduction. I thought I'd start off by mentioning who we are. Both of us came up to Trinity in 1974, and we followed different paths, because when we came up, the Standard Model had just been finished. That basically happened in 1973. So what do you do once theoretical physics has been solved? Well, I went for pure mathematics, and Robert went for experimental physics. So I became a cryptographer, and I ended up then doing hardware security stuff. So one of the things I'm known for is semi-invasive reverse engineering. The idea here is that you illuminate a smart card chip with a laser by scanning across the surface, and where it gets switched off, that creates extra leakage current. And with a little bit of signal processing, you can create a false color image which tells you which memory bits were 1 and 0 without using the readout circuitry supplied for the purpose. So we've done all sorts of things like that and used maths in all sorts of interesting ways to break stuff. And although I'm apparently respectable as a university professor, I warn you today's material is heretical. Do not quote this in the Tripos, unless you want to end up stepping shoals at Sainsbury's. But it is an awful lot of fun, and I think it might be incredibly important. Robert's background, he did experimental physics. He invented the squid gyro. That's now led to a £20 million hub in quantum navigation, where people believe that you can use things like Bose-Einstein condensates to figure out where you are. He was then a research fellow at Trinity and did a startup which ended as a software company. And so the two of us ended up doing research on things like, can you use models from statistical mechanics to understand software bugs better?
Now, the current story starts in just before Christmas 2011.
Because, as you may recall, there was some news came out from CERN which said that neutrinos travel faster than light. And, what's going on here? So, we went down the pub. This is the pub in Bourne. And we sat and we said, well, okay. So that's special relativity gone then. So, I mean, this opens up all possibilities. How on earth does the universe work? Where on earth does the Lorentz transform come from? Well, surely it's got to be some kind of, right, because things and fluids have, they obey the wave equation, and so they have Lorentz symmetry baked in. But how on earth have you got a negative dielectric coefficient? How on earth could you have a wave that would travel faster through the Earth than it travelled through empty space? And, of course, there's no obvious answer to that, because we don't know how to make metamaterials of an appropriate type. And then, in early 2012, Robert had this idea: a solution to Euler's equation that's also a solution to the Lorentz equation. And here's an example. What you get is a torus, and this is an irrotational flow, where you get a line of maximum pressure and a line of minimum pressure. They go around both axes of a torus. And so if you can imagine the torus turning, then the fluid goes through, but it also goes round. And so you get chirality. Perhaps you care to pass that around. And there's another to go around the other way. Now, for revision, this is Euler's equation. It's just our old friend, manufactured here in Trinity, F equals ma. Okay, so minus grad p is rho du by dt. That's the total derivative. And as you recall from fluid dynamics, part 1b, from vector calculus in 1a, you separate that into partial derivatives, and that is the basic equation which tells you how fluids without loss, without viscosity, operate. And in particular, it's one of the foundations of superfluid hydrodynamics. You'll also recall from quantum mechanics too that this is Dirac's equation. This describes how an electron operates, and so the time derivative is this sum which involves Dirac matrices that are made up from Pauli spin matrices. And the amazing thing is that flux rings with a single twist obey the Dirac's equation. So they behave like electrons and positrons.
And the paper on this, Robert presented at the Trinity Science Society in October 2013, the beginning of last academic year. Was anybody here for that talk? Nope. Okay. Oh, one. Great. Thanks, Ed. So this is a bit of a wow experience. I mean, you don't expect things in superfluids to behave like electrons. So is it observable? Well, it turns out that it is. Because in a superfluid, if you cool helium down below 2.1 degrees Kelvin, the lambda point, then it appears to be a normal fluid and a superfluid, kind of mixed to each other and superposed. But when you look more carefully, the normal fluid is made up of a number of excitations, many of which are rotons, and these are believed to be vortices in the superfluid. And in a very cold, still superfluid, you can create one-off rotons by cooling an ion very, very slowly through the fluid, about a millimeter per second. Now, if you cool an ion really, really fast, 40 meters per second, which is a sixth of the speed of sound in helium, then you produce roton pairs, which are called R plus and R minus rotons. And these have the feature that if you measure the angle at which atoms of helium are kicked out of the surface of the helium using a bolometer, you find that they kick the atoms out in different directions. And it's entirely obvious to visualize that if you have rotons with different chirality and they're hitting the surface, then you will get exactly that behavior. So far, so good. We appear to have a twisted flat plane model which explains R plus and R minus rotons. So far, so cool. A nice, perhaps unimportant result in low temperature physics. But
flux rings have got the same behavior as the electron, perhaps they're a model of the electron. And in theoretical physics, as you know, we've got a big problem in that quantum mechanics, the standard model, explains how stuff operates at the very small. General relativity explains how stuff operates at very large scales, and the two appear to be incompatible. So there's a whole bunch of different schools of people who try to do quantum gravity, which means trying to think up theories that could explain both quantum mechanics on the one hand and general relativity on the other. String theory is being in Cambridge, for example. But something that we do in Moscow, and I'm pretty sure Volodik is strong in this, is what's called superfluid quantum gravity. And the idea here is that fluids have got the same symmetries of general relativity as well as special relativity. And you can, in fact, do experiments where you create virtual black holes, acoustic black holes in Bose-Einstein condensates. That's been done in both Israel and Canada. And you can also observe that a number of the symmetries of the standard model are there in the helium, including even the Higgs mechanism. And there's a big book on this you can read, The Universe in a Helium Droplet by Grisha Volovic. You can find online and learn more. Now, in Grisha's model, he assumes that the quantum vacuum is like helium-3 because he doesn't know how to have a quasi particle, which is fermionic, which is spin half. But now we've got one, namely the thing that we've just been passing around here. So perhaps the quantum vacuum is like helium-4, that is normal helium, of which we have got enormous quantities and we do lots of experiments. So, my reaction to this is, wow, maybe this explains why quantum computing has been stuck at 3 qubits since forever. Right? Because in my field, in cryptography, there's all these guys come along and say, we've got these quantum computers, which will factor all your large PGP keys, and therefore you better start thinking again and perhaps use our quantum cryptographic system. And despite 20-odd years and enormous amounts of money spent on this project, never produced any engineering that actually works. So I suggested that this might perhaps be a reason, and you wouldn't believe the amount of angry denunciation that came our way. So this is the sort of stuff that I could say. This is a cartoon that appeared in a link in Scott Anderson's blog. Scott is the top quantum computing guru in the world. Doctor, we have this pet physicist and something's wrong. He keeps babbling about linguistics and neurology and climate science.
He's a little old, isn't he? How do you know? Well, the physicist's a natural life cycle. Juvenile physicists mostly roll around in books, Once they reach maturity, they're productive and fun, but well, as they get on in years, they reach the telling other fields they're wrong about everything that is. There's nothing you can do. I'm afraid it's really best to put it that. And so it goes on, and so it goes on. Dozens and dozens and dozens of fun things. Okay. So one of the things that we realized from that is that many of the people who are doing quantum computing don't know very much about computation or about physics either, for that matter. And there's also the thing that many physicists, at least in the theoretical physics side, simply won't contemplate a classical or even comprehensible basis for quantum mechanics. For many people in the pavilion, it seems to be a point of pride that physics is too difficult for anybody to understand, and only we are clever enough to realize why that is. So there's a psychological and sociological block here, as well as simply a failure to be able to make the sums add up.
So what can we do about it? Well, bouncing droplet experiments are fun. Let me just show a brief video. And in fact, it was Keith Muffett who suggested, when we went to know this work, that we look at Eve Coudet's work and introduced Robert to Eve, and we went over to Paris and we met
the
Eve.
The trial begins here.
This is his lab.
With a drop of silicon. In his Paris laboratory, physicist Eve Coudet and his team conduct an amazing series of experiments. They are observing the behavior of silicon droplets bouncing in lockstep on a vibrating plate.
The liquid of the drop never touches the liquid of the substrate. So they're always separated by an air film. And in fact, this is stable. You can keep the drop bouncing on the liquid surface for several days if you wish.
Using a camera that shoots 1,000 frames per second, Coudet has discovered that these droplets mimic behavior seen in the quantum world. And that shouldn't be possible, because the quantum world and the large-scale world play by two different sets of rules. Yet here we see a single droplet moving randomly like a quantum particle, but behaving like a quantum wave. If you watch this carefully, you'll notice that the wave appears to be guiding the droplet. In fact, the wave fields around the droplets develop a memory of the trails they have followed. Despite their random behavior, they follow a small number of paths. Again, this is eerily similar to the behavior of quantum objects. This runs so contrary to popular belief that at first, Coudet refused to believe what he was seeing.
In the NF physics experiments, you only see what you are prepared to see. Of course, this was very obvious that there was a memory, but it took us some time to realize that it was that we were observing, because you have to adapt this new idea.
Perhaps most revealing of all, Coudet has reproduced the double-slit experiment using his bouncing silicon droplets. The mystery of quantum mechanics is, how can things like electrons sometimes behave like particles and sometimes behave like waves? Perhaps this is the answer. They are particles and waves. Of course, this system, though small, is not quantum.
Our system is not a model of quantum mechanics, but it is an association of a particle and a wave, and some of its properties are similar to the properties that are observed in quantum mechanics.
Okay, I'm just going to go through this quickly so that I can hand over to Robert in 5 minutes for the rest of the talk. But this is the equipment. You've got a tray of oil sitting on a vibrator. The droplet bounces, and it is driven by the forcing vibration.
The photograph shows a single bounce, but it's actually the double period bounce that shows us most of the interesting quantum effects. They occur typically between 3.5 and 4 Gs of applied force between about 30 and 70 hertz in frequency. And here's the thing that got us going. Photograph of a droplet Miranda tray, which was taken back in 2006 by Susie Protier, one of today's research students. As you will see, the angle of incidence is based on the angle of reflection. So we plotted this, and we find it was an inverse square force. Aha! Now, if you've done fluid mechanics, you may have heard of the second Bjerknes force. This is an inverse square force discovered by this guy, Carl Bjerknes, in the 1880s. What he did was to fill up two bladders, in water and fill them with a bicycle pump, so that he could inflate and deflate them in synchrony. And he found that you got an inverse square force between them that was either attractive or repulsive, depending on whether you're in phase or out of phase. It's a tricos level problem to show this. In algebraic terms, the force V grad P is got a cos squared omega T component that is always positive. Or if you prefer to think geometrically, look at the line of symmetry between two droplets and you'll see that there's a decreased Bernoulli pressure as droplet flows away along the line. This is well-established engineering. If you buy an oil degasser, it's an ultrasonic transducer that you put in some oil, and this causes the droplets to attract each other, coalesce into larger droplets, and rise to the surface. So this is well known, and you can write it down in exactly the same terms as you write down the electromagnetic force. The constants are different, of course. C, the speed of light in electromagnetism, becomes the speed of surface waves. Planck's constant becomes a different constant. And so on, but the form of the equations is the same. Now, in electromagnetism, of course, you've got the Lorentz contraction, and Lorentz plus inverse square force gives you Maxwell's equations. Do you have that here? Well, as you increase the driving force, so the droplet walks faster because it touches down further with each cycle. And when you do the observations, you get the graph there, and when you do the analysis, you come to the conclusion that a neat way of modeling this is the volume of the normal vessel function as the depression, as a droplet wave field. When the droplet is moving, then the wave equation is symmetric under the Lorentz transform, so you expect that if f, x, y, t is a solution, then f, x, dash, y, dash, t, dash will also be a solution, or this is the standard Lorentz transform that we're familiar with. Now, will this work or not? That's an empirical question. And it turns out, when you graph out the data, that this is in fact the case. So, Susie kept the data, we got in touch with her, we got the data, we checked it. And that's a fairly large gamma, 2.7, 2.8 or so, that turns out to be the case. So, what this means is that the inverse square secondary Bjerknes force must also be symmetric under acoustic Lorentz transformation, and that means inverse square force plus Lorentz symmetry gives you Maxwell's equation. And it turns out that's exactly what we observe. And that is the reason why you've got the angle of incidence. So having realized that we've got a decent model here, we did a bit more work. This is all in the summer of 2013. And we realized, I'm going to skip through this because that basically if you get a droplet pair, that enables you to look at the magnetic force because the Coulomb force tends to work. And so you can observe the way in which droplet pairs skip along the boundary of the tray. And you can measure that, and you get the appropriate fine structure constant, and so on. And the further experimental results include, for example, single slit and two slit diffraction, tunneling, where a droplet plus associated wave field may or may not go over an obstacle, depending on how the obstacle, and quantized orbits, which we saw in the video. Now, all of these were reported at various times by the French team. How can you get all these phenomena out? Well, simply because when you do the math, you end up getting the same pattern once more. And the key thing here is that the height of the surface of the fluid can be decomposed into two factors, psi times chi, where chi is the driving acceleration you get from the vibrating plate, and psi turns out to have the same characteristics as the familiar quantum. I don't have time to go into all the details, and Robert's going to pick up on how this works in three dimensions. But just as an example of how this can be useful in thinking about quantum mechanics, here's the single slip diffraction case. And you can see here is the chi wave, that is the vessel function, which is given by the time of acceleration of the droplet that's happened. And here is the psi, because you can see the phase changes here, and that's because the psi is going from positive to negative. And this enables you for the first time to actually visualize the analog of a quantum mechanical wave function. Up until now, this was all mysterious stuff that you just had to believe. Now you can see an analog of it with your own eyes. And you can also understand what phase space means, because the wave function psi ends up being a function of the position and momentum of all the droplets in the plate. Oh, and you get the Klein-Garvin equation and the Schrödinger equation for low velocity approximation. So that is, at the heart of it, the explanation of why bouncing droplets behave like quantum mechanical particles. Because they follow the same equations and so you get the same solutions. Here, what's happening, remember, is that psi is the modulation, the underlying driving oscillation chi, which creates across the plate, a long-range orbit. That's the key idea. And now Robert will go on and talk about how this works in three dimensions.
So I want to move on to some more recent work, which actually goes on ArcSieve Monday, which is to do with what happened in three dimensions. Now, actually, it turns out Ross and I and these guys in ECUDE in Paris and so on aren't the first heretics. Quite a few people were heretical in exactly the same way. And when you do some, when you do the literature search, it actually goes quite, these models go quite a long way back. It starts in 1746, someone called Leonhard Euler. He said, well, light must be acoustic waves in a frictionless, compressible fluid. Just like the air, actually, but imagine the air without any viscosity, just sound waves. And he was able to explain things like refraction, diffraction, and interference. And you've probably seen these types of interference-type patterns. The problem with his theory, which turned out to be fatal for it, was that it doesn't explain why light is polarized. Furthermore, something that was discovered later on, it doesn't explain why light is absorbed discretely, something Einstein discovered in 1905. Okay. There was a second heretic, exactly 100 years later, Michael Faraday. He had a model of light which had exactly the opposite problem. He said, well, if you've got particles, particles are connected by lines of force. These lines of force give you the force between them, but actually it's how particles interact. And light is waves in these lines of force. So, of course, these waves are polarized and they are absorbed discretely. But it doesn't explain refraction, diffraction, and interference to apparently completely opposite models of light. Of course, 15 years later, someone came along and combined those two models. His name was James Clerk Maxwell. He said, well, a magnetic, which I'll come to this in a great more detail now, a magnetic line of force is what he called a molecular vortex in a fluid-like medium. So this is a diagram from his 1861 paper reproduced. what he said is, well, there's fluid flowing around a line, a bit like a vortex, I suppose. And so there's centrifugal forces will reduce the pressure near the centre. So there's reduced pressure near the centre. That gives a tension, which accounts not... He explained why this accounts not just for the attraction between the poles of magnets, but also the repulsion between the poles. Very interesting paper. And he did some further calculations, which I'm going to express in modern notation, which you're probably familiar. It starts with P bar, which is the momentum of the fluid per unit volume in this diagram. First thing is you define a magnetic field by B is curl P bar. So you get what's now called Gauss's law for magnetism, which you undoubtedly have been using. Here B equals zero from that vector identity. Second thing he said in his, it took pages and pages to do this because he didn't have vector algebra, is that magnetic flux defined by phi is the integral of the magnetic field over a distance. And of course, the flux called E is called E bar. You can use Stokes' theorem. The flux is the integral of the momentum around a line. So this is, his molecular vortex has magnetic flux. Third thing he derived for this model was, well, if you define E as the force, if the fluid exerts a force per unit volume on an external system, then from the conservation of momentum, E must equal minus d momentum by d time. Rate of change in momentum, that's Newton's second law. If you take the curl of that, you get Faraday's law of induction, curl E is minus dB by dt. These are two or two and a half of Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism, the ones that relate to the magnetic field. And he derived them for this model. Subsequently, this model was rejected, and I'll explain to you why later. So let's have a look at how we might update his magnetic line of force or molecular vortex using what we now know nowadays. First of all, what are the constraints on it? Well, a molecular vortex can be any axis with mass flowing around it. At the time, they only really thought about what's called an ordinary vortex. But it's not a good example. An ordinary vortex is pinned to the fluid. It's constrained. If the fluid's moving along, an ordinary vortex will move along with it. And a consequence of this is that an ordinary vortex is not symmetric under the Lorentz transformation. But Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism are symmetric under the Lorentz transformation. So an ordinary vortex is not a good model of a magnetic line of force. But of course, we now know, possibly wasn't known at the time, that there's a second order and third order equivalent of a vortex. An ordinary vortex is not the only possibility. Maxwell didn't know that magnetic flux is quantized. These are experiments on my PhD in superconductivity, actually. A superconductor has what's called an order parameter, which you write R e to the is. R is the amplitude and S is the phase. And when a superconducting loop, this is a superconducting loop, it's part of a device called a squid, actually, when it encloses n quanta of magnetic flux, flux defined in the way Maxwell defined it, then the phase S advances by 2n pi around the loop. And you can write this, make sure grad S dot dl is 2n pi. This is what you write down. Say that's the rate of change. Sure you understand that. Now, I did a PhD in superconductivity, and I thought that was the end of it. And it's only recently I discovered that this thing has a name in fluid mechanics. called a phase vortex, which is, and a phase vortex is the thing that Maxwell missed. Here's a phase vortex. My very chambers large up to a Maudley in 1980. And the guys who popularized it. Very famous experiment. They had water waves going past a steady vortex. Here, the water waves are traveling from right to left. The vortex is flowing that way. They actually just have a tank of water and, you know, with a hole in it. And what happens is, the water is flowing around like this. So above here, the waves going from right to left travel more slowly. Notice there's one extra wave crest above the centre than below it. So what happens is the phase of the wave advances by 2 inches around the centre. In other words, this is the equation that I've been using for many years in my PhD. Suddenly you find it actually exists in fluid mechanics. It's actually quite well known. Furthermore, these guys said, you know what, this is really strange. We've measured an analogue of a magnetic effect called the Aharon-Ohm, which I won't go into detail. And other people have measured other magnetic-like effects in these phase vortices, which indicate these phase vortices experimentally appear to behave like magnetic lines of force. This suggests an update for Maxwell's magnetic line of force. It's a solution to the equations for Euler's compressible fluid. The first order, Euler's fluid, just obeys the wave equation, d2 rho is the density, d to rho by dt squared minus c squared. This is the speed of sound. Del squared rho is naught. This is a solution using a Bessel function. Jn is a Bessel function. And it looks like this. As you can see, this here is an area where the material is more dense. Here it's less dense. This is J1 solution. And this whole thing rotates around the centre. And this is a sort of extension on the Z axis. Which means there's a chirality associated with it. And it turns out that it has this very property that Maxwell, in his original paper, described equal p bar dot p r not equal to naught. And therefore, you get it obeys Maxwell's equations for a magnetic line of force. Furthermore, the phase S increases by 2n pi. So magnetic flux is quantized, which is also observed. And finally, this thing, the first order at least, obeys the wave equation. And anything which is obeys the wave, any solutions, all solutions to the wave equation are symmetric under the Lorentz transformation, which is exactly what you require for Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism. Let's have a look at the consequences of Faraday's model of light, where you'll recall Faraday said that light is waves in lines of force. Well, easy to imagine you have an amplitude modulated wave packet in a line of force. This is the line of force. So which has you can write down immediately it's very so it has chiral symmetry. Same symmetry as circularly polarized light. It has a small amplitude around at large distance. It's only got a reasonable amplitude near the center. So it'll only interact with a small system if the line of force passes very close to it. In other words, it is absorbed discretely, as Einstein discovered in 1905. and it turns out it obeys Maxwell's equation for first order. There's another example, linearly polarized light. This is also a solution to the wave equation for first order. And this is the cross-section, and this is what the amplitude looks like along the z-axis. This has an oscillating dipole parallel to frequency naught. And amplitude modulation of this thing gives you linearly polarized light. Various values of kz. At least by extending Faraday's model of light. There's a set of experiments called the Bell test experiments. Let's have a look at how this might work. Here I've got something called a polarizer, which, in view of time, I'm going to cut this rather short. You're going to have to look at the paper if you want to see it in detail. Essentially, this is a line of force which does not couple to the polarizer. You imagine a polarizer has dipoles up and down. So this is the line of force with dipoles that direction, which does not couple to the polarizer and actually carries on through into large distance. If you get some disturbance that couples to that line of force, then it will send a wave packet in this direction and a wave packet in that direction. And these two wave packets will both pass through the polarizers and will be detected. So you'll get 100% correlation between the two measurements. Likewise, if you can also have lines of force oriented perpendicular to this, which actually do couple to the dipoles in the polarizer. If the source stimulates the line of force in the opposite direction, then of course wave packets coming along here will be absorbed by the polarizer from the opposite, and likewise the other direction. And again, you'll get no measurement on a photomultiplier at the other end. And again, you get 100% correlation when the polarizers are parallel, which is what is observed and difficult to explain in unless you get weird quantum mechanics stuff. Turns out that if you rotate one of these by an angle phi, you get a positive pi correlation, which is exactly the correlation predicted under quantum mechanics. Now, the interesting thing here is that in 1969, people called Clan, von Schimmelke, and Holt made an assumption. They assume that polarization is only carried by and localized within a photon or a wave packet, which is not true on Faraday's model of light. On Faraday's model of light, the directionality is pre-existing. And they concluded that this result here, the cos 2 pi, is impossible. And from their conclusion, they came to the conclusion that there must be some process that happens faster than light, which is transmits information faster than light, but is not capable of transmitting signals faster than light somehow. Or, alternatively, we must have parallel universes. So, conclusion. And this is rather heretical. Euler in 1746 may be right. Light is waves in a frictionless compressible fluid, guided by Faraday, Maxwell, lines of force. In other words, these guys got to it well before we did. Well before Yves Coudet did with his Bouts and Proctor's experiments. The waves obey Maxwell's full equations to first order, they're polarized, absorbed discreetly, and consistent with the Bell tests. There are two other fields of study which are connected with this, which we touched on very briefly. There's a field of study called analog gravity, where this is founded on the observation that a compressible fluid symmetries of general relativity as well as those of special relativity. And they've done a number of experiments, most notably on an analog of the Hawking radiation in a near a black hole. And there's another field called emergent quantum mechanics, which is really the study of these bouncing droplets and other related phenomena. And other things like cellular automata and so on, which tie in with this. And this possibly provides a bit of a history for this study. So our heretical program is as follows. This is what we're trying to do, and we won't achieve it without any help. It is to derive all of physics from Euler's equation for a compressible fluid. And there's one way to show we are wrong, that Euler's hypothesis that the universe is filled by a thing called an ether, which is a compressible fluid, one way to prove that that is wrong is by failing in any area that you choose. It is testable. These are the papers. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions by the Dr. Brady or Professor Anders? Well, if there are no questions, can we thank them again? I know I'm seeing some of you later for the dinner. If not, there's no talk on Monday, quite obviously, because there's been quite a few talks today, and, well, the committee's tired. So we'll see you all the following Monday for the debate between Professor Lieber and Dr. Thomas Paul.